Hello and welcome back to History and Politics, the Körber Stiftung's podcast that explores how and why history shapes our present. My name is Florian Bigge and I'm pleased to introduce Katja Heuer and Oliver Moody, who are hosting this special podcast series, The New Germany. This is episode 3 of season 3, and we are honored to have General Ben Hodges, former commanding general of the US Army in Europe, as our guest. Now, over to you, Katja and Oliver.
Aber Hachi's face displays sorrow and pain. Dark clouds overshadow the land where the Shoshone live.
Go again.
Aber Hachi and his white blood brother rangers say how to Big Chief for the Shoshone, stinking loser.
What was that?
Oh, only a scene from one of the most successful German movies of all time.
It didn't sound an awful lot like Das Boot.
Well, this film received 6 fewer Oscar nominations than Das Boot, which is to say none. but it's the most watched German production in Germany itself by some margin. It must be its classic lines such as, "Not so fast, Jacqueline, or you'll puke again."
Classic. This has got to be the shoe of Manitou, obviously. A very silly parody of Western movies. And this one's described by the International Encyclopedia of Film as a completely mindless review without fear of using trivialities and dirty jokes in order to entertain in a superficial and silly way.
I take it you're not a fan then?
I haven't actually seen it, but I am not so sure that being the most successful German film production of all time is necessarily the endorsement that it sounds like. Because I took a look at the list and I had to go an unbelievably long way down past Fuck You, Goethe, Fuck You, Goethe 2, Fuck You, Goethe 3, Seven Dwarfs, Men Alone in the Forest, The Miracle of Love, Sexuality and Marriage, and Schoolgirl Report, What Parents Don't Believe is Possible, to number 45 before I found a film I'd actually seen.
Yeah, that is shocking. That is a bit of an indictment as to what Germans watch in their spare time, I dare say. I mean, Der Schuh des Manitou is really an interesting phenomenon because it is so silly. I mean, you know, it's kind of Mel Brooks type humor, I would say, only a German version of it. But it became so popular that people actually quote lines from it in their daily lives. I mean, there's, for instance, a scene in there where all of the cowboys kind of ride out to do something, and before they leave, they sort of say, "All right, everybody go to the loo," and then we ride. You know, and that's become such a catchphrase now that when you kind of leave the house, you say that, kind of, "Oh, everybody go to the loo," and then we ride, you know, which is interesting how much of a cultural phenomenon it's become that people can actually quote from it.
So like Germany's version of Blazing Saddles, except you can actually quote the lines because they're not blatantly racist.
Well, I dare say if you made the film now, there are lots of things in there, not least the fact that there's kind of cliched, somewhat hackneyed version of a gay Indian leader figure in there, which I don't think you could kind of do today without creating some controversy.
Well, you've really sold me on it.
Well, in all of that excitement about a Wild West populated by bizarre Bavarians in costumes, we've forgotten to introduce ourselves. I'm Katja Heuer, a German-born historian and writer living in the open prairies of Norfolk, England.
And I'm Oliver Moody, a British journalist traipsing from saloon bar to saloon bar in Berlin.
Right, so back to our original question. Starting this episode on The New Germany with a silly pastiche of the Western genre was, of course, not entirely gratuitous. We're on season 3 now of this podcast, and we're still trying to work out what Germany's past can reveal about its present and future. And there are a few topics where this approach is more helpful, I think, than in exploring Germany's relationship with the US, which is the topic of today's episode. America has loomed large in Germany's collective psyche, and light entertainment as it may be, I think Der Schuh des Manitou was so successful because it can rely on the fact that German viewers are extremely familiar with Western themes, which is basically trying to caricature. So, you know, we talked about the bizarre list of the most famous and most successful German films earlier. After Der Schuh des Manitou, the next two on the list are Treasure of the Silver Lake from 1962 and Apache Gold from 1963. And they're both Westerns based on Winnetou novels, which the German author Karl May, who is incidentally the most successful German author you've never heard of, wrote back in the 19th century.
Karl May, I actually have heard of.
Of course you have.
Yeah, he's pretty obscure outside Germany, but it's really quite hard to live in Germany for any great length of time and escape him. And I think this phenomenon is totally fascinating. Last autumn, I took a train to a town near Hamburg called Bad Segeberg, where there is an amphitheatre carved out of an old chalk mine on the top of a hill. And around this amphitheatre, there's a kind of a sham Wild West village. And the whole setup is entirely dedicated to staging the works of this author. Karl May was a weaver's son from Saxony, born in 1842. Quite an unsavoury Baron Munchausen sort of character who used to go around stealing things and spinning the most preposterous stories to con people. Maybe the biggest con of them all was in 1880 when Karl May, who had never by that point set foot outside Europe, started publishing these racy stories about an Apache chief called Winnetou and his loyal German-American blood brother, Old Shatterhand. And it's quite hard to convey how popular May's writing was and still is. But if you think that the Lord of the Rings books have sold about 150 million copies around the world, Karl May's books have sold more than 200 million copies, despite the not inconsiderable handicap of being mainly published in the German language. And the cult around them is extraordinary. If you go to the Karl May Festival in Bad Segeberg, it's the most bonkers experience. You have thousands of people in the amphitheatre every night, and a lot of them are dressed up as cowboys and Indians, watching these big-budget dramatisations of Karl May's books with sing-alongs and live animals and pyrotechnics and gunfights and self-driving cars and a huge quantity of slapstick humour. And the closest thing I can think of for British listeners is high-end panto. Or for our American friends, I suppose you have the Republican caucus in the House of Representatives. Just one more thing. Karl May sort of came to think that he really was Old Shatterhand in quite a real sense, which becomes a bit of a trope. You do, after him, get a lot of Germans who start kind of genuinely identifying with cowboys and Indians.
Yeah, and I mean, as you said, you know, Karl May is the best example. He even had three of the legendary rifles which feature in his books made for himself. I mean, who doesn't want their own bear killer at home?
I think you've already lived in Norfolk for too long, Kircher. the reason we're banging on so much about this is because these books and these films have still today an astonishingly powerful hold over German pop culture and the imagined image of America in Germany, and have often been, especially under the 20th century dictatorships, a kind of sanctuary for a nostalgic and half mythologized version of the romantic true Germany, unsullied by capitalism and heavy industry. So Einstein was a big fan, as very famously was Adolf Hitler. But then you did get this kind of weird effect known as Indiana Tumulai, or I guess obsession with Indianness, where people after the Second World War on both sides of the divide in Germany started living as Indians. And from the 1970s, you get this great proliferation of Wild West bars and saloons and steakhouses and even quite a few theme parks. And of course, Winnetou did resurface in the news in 2022 when there was a great moral panic after a German publisher withdrew a couple of the children's books from sale because they supposedly involved cultural appropriation and perpetuated racist stereotypes. And this culture war culminated in the frankly insane spectacle of the Deputy Prime Minister of Bavaria turning up on stage at a political rally dressed as Winnetou.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it, how central this is to German culture and Germanness, that, you know, you get a whole kind of Kulturkampf like debate around, you know, where Winnetou and the Karl May stories overall kind of fit in. You know, are they still okay, or should they be banned? I mean, the fact that this is making so many people so angry on both sides of that debate, you know, just shows how central this is. And I think this kind of ongoing German fascination for America has very deep roots. I mean, even when you go all the way back a few centuries, you've from the beginning, basically since white settlement happened in America, you get a German fascination with that as well, this idea of kind of freedom, of open wide landscapes, and all of this kind of romanticization of America is there right from the beginning, which also means that lots and lots of Germans settle in America. Even today, around 45 million people in the US self-identify as German Americans. That's nearly 14% of the American population.
So why did you get so many Germans in America?
Well, they were really part of the kind of settlement story from the beginning. I mean, when the very first English settlers arrived at Jamestown, Virginia in 1607, they already had the first German American with them, a man called Johannes Fleischer. So they were there from the outset, if a minority, of course, but kind of there alongside the settlers from Britain. The biggest wave came in the century before the First World War. When you look at the period when it peaks between 1840 and 1880, they were the largest group of immigrants to America. I mean, of course, many were driven out of the German lands by repression. So, for instance, you've got the famous 48er generation that fled Europe after the 1848-1849 revolutions, when the governments were cracking down hard on intellectuals, on socialists, on liberals, and so on. So many of them fled. There were also many social pressures due to urbanization and industrialization. So many workers or kind of people who'd previously worked in farming also felt that they could have better opportunities in the US. And they shared Karl May's, you know, sort of enthusiasm for the ideal of America, namely as a land of kind of opportunities, of space, of somewhere where you can settle on your own piece of land, and of adventure. And I think these kind of things combined with the social and political pressures very powerfully to drive literally millions of Germans out of Europe and into the New World.
And presumably this massive constituency of German Americans makes getting involved in the two world wars and managing their aftermath pretty difficult for the US administrations.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, they go back and forth a little bit at the time between, you know, open anti-German sentiment in the US. So people are being interned, for example, and there's signs up saying no Germans here, you know, kind of the idea that you have the enemy in your own country is one side of that. But you also get huge segment of the American population who certainly after both of the wars is quite sympathetic and doesn't want the punishment or kind of any treaties that come out of them to be too harsh on Germany either. There'd also been really strong business links between the two countries in both places. And, you know, that many people in the US were very keen to rekindle those after the First and the Second World War. So, for example, the fact that the US never signs the Treaty of Versailles after the First World War has, of course, a lot to do with the fact that America doesn't want to get entangled in Europe too much. But there's also a huge kind of part of the electorate with German sympathies kind of saying this treaty is too harsh and it shouldn't be signed, so they never do. Nonetheless, you get a lot of American goodwill afterwards as well, particularly along the lines of getting the economy back going in Germany. So, for example, after the First World War, you have the Dawes and the Young plans, both financial plans to try and help the German economy back up with huge amounts of loans, of money. Of course, this also shackles the German economy to a very overheated American economy with devastating consequences between the two wars. But even after the Second World War, you get a very similar kind of theme again, if you will, despite the fact that the Second World War and the Holocaust deeply shocked Americans, you still get, you know, this kind of realization that actually Germany can be a partner once more, namely when the Cold War starts to emerge and the ideas that, you know, Germany needs to be rebuilt. I mean, you still get this bizarre situation where there's a struggle within America, you know, whether Germany should be punished at that point or rebuilt. So, for example, Treasury Secretary Henry Morgenthau suggested that Germany should be split up after the Second World War, demilitarized, and then only be allowed to build an economy that is based on basically on harmless things like
teddy bears.
Yeah, actually, yes. Toys were on Morgenthau's allowed list, as were several other things like leather goods and beers and wines and spirits and musical instruments and textiles and things like that. Because Morgenthau was basically worried that once Germans had enough to eat, they would basically regain their strength. And once they were allowed to put engines back into cars, they might be tempted to get in those cars and drive east.
I'm not sure why Morgenthau was prepared to trust parts of the German population with leather goods at the time, to be honest.
It's probably Lederhosen he was thinking of.
Well, luckily for the western parts of Germany, the threat from the east obviously became a more significant worry for the Americans than a resurgence of a nationalistic Germany. So Morgenthau's plan is dropped for good in 1947, and instead the US decides to build West Germany back up as a central ally in the Cold War. And Herbert Hoover, who'd been US president during the Great Depression, was asked to tour Europe and suggest a strategy for its recovery. And when he saw the misery in post-war Germany, he concluded, "The whole economy of Europe is interlinked with the German economy. The productivity of Europe cannot be restored without the restoration of Germany."
So in other words, Germany was no longer the enemy and the Soviet Union was instead. So West Germany had to be built up as the westernmost outpost, if you will, of American influence in Europe. So 2 years after the end of the most devastating war the world had ever seen, the Joint Chiefs actually declared in Washington that, and I quote, "the complete revival of the German industry, particularly coal mining, was now of primary importance to American security."
Yeah, the first West German Chancellor, Konrad Adenauer, made himself a staunch ally in this plan. We've already talked in the France episode a bit about his Westbindung orientation towards the West as a way out of the geopolitical mire. But Adenauer, I think, went beyond that and was able to use his, recognize the leverage that he had with the US as this frontline state, and even to kind of squeeze the occasional concession out of Washington. And so he is not only allowed but encouraged to re-establish the German armed forces just like 10 years after the Wehrmacht had wreaked devastation all over Europe. He gets a very large amount of Marshall aid from the US that helps to fuel the so-called Wirtschaftswunder or economic miracle of the 1950s. And the German, West German-American relationship through the rest of the Cold War is fascinating. We are recording this episode barely 24 hours after the death of Henry Kissinger, and I think it's a good excuse to come back to Ostpolitik, as we have already revisited in previous series of the podcast, because it was just so utterly formative for the modern German understanding of geopolitics. So just to recap, it's the end of the 1960s. Willy Brandt, the first social democratic chancellor of West Germany, begins pursuing detente with the Warsaw Pact states and begins to secure the flow of oil and gas through pipelines from the USSR. And there are still some German social democrats who will talk about this policy as one of the really decisive contributing factors to the end of the Cold War. Be that as it may, what is often forgotten about this period from a German perspective is that Ostpolitik dovetailed with a parallel detente strategy that the US was pursuing under Nixon and Kissinger after the Vietnam War. And when you read Kissinger's memoirs, it's clear he profoundly mistrusted Brandt and thought Egon Bahr, Brandt's closest foreign policy advisor, was something like a Soviet asset. And Kissinger was at first so skeptical of West German Ostpolitik that he told Zhu Enlai at the time that it was dangerous to underestimate German short-sightedness. The important aspect of this period for the purposes of the present is that West Germany and the US, in the grand scheme of things, ultimately ended up pulling in more or less the same direction, but for really quite different reasons and with a fair amount of mutual suspicion, which I think is quite a neat way to characterize a lot of the disagreements that they've had since then.
Well, you could certainly argue that there's, you know, mutual what alignment really of their interest is, I think, the main strand really of this post-war relationship. I mean, you do have West Germany joining NATO right from the beginning, accepting American leadership of this arrangement. I think the pinnacle of that, you could say, is the, you know, whole idea of nuclear sharing. So the fact that Germany doesn't get its own nuclear weapons, but it does train its pilots who deliver American nuclear bombs, which are stationed on German soil. And, you know, that is quite a really interlinked relationship there between Germany and the US that requires a lot of trust, you know, on both sides to make that work. I think it's also interesting that obviously later on you get German and American forces fighting side by side after reunification and conflicts like Afghanistan, for example, or Yugoslavia. And also this kind of romanticization of the US, I think, has never really gone away, as we discussed earlier. You still have this kind of love for America as the country of the Wild West. So happy ending then for the German-American relationship?
No, certainly not an ending and not always happy. Famously, in 2003, under the chancellorship of Gerhard Schröder, Germany refuses to sign up to the US-led coalition invading Iraq, which causes an acrimonious rift with Washington that is subsequently repaired by Angela Merkel, who, despite or probably more precisely because of her youth in East Germany, has an extremely deep-seated affection for America, although not always for its foreign and security policy. And over her 16 years as Chancellor, Merkel has a very up-and-down relationship with successive American presidents. She gets along famously with George W. Bush right up to the notorious NATO summit in Bucharest in 2008, where, as we've talked about in a previous episode, Germany and the US parted ways over Ukraine and Georgia's hopes of joining the alliance. Merkel got off to a very frosty start with Obama, before developing a pretty good mutual understanding, which is then shredded over security in 2017 with the advent of Donald Trump, who fixates on Germany as the avatar and embodiment of everything he thinks is wrong with the Europeans, not least the Nord Stream 1 and 2 gas pipelines from Russia and Berlin's persistent failure to meet the NATO target to spend 2% of its GDP on defence. And finally, in 2021, Biden comes along with a foreign policy team full of old Obama staffers who have, on the whole, a very high opinion of Merkel and of Germany. And the central plank of Biden's Europe policy is repairing the transatlantic relationship with Berlin, because Britain has left the EU, France is France, and Germany really becomes the key European partner for the Biden administration, to the point where Washington even gives up basically on trying to block the Nord Stream 2 pipeline, despite thinking it's a terrible idea. And the interactions between Scholz and Biden on Ukraine have been fascinating. If you talk to Scholz's allies, they are very insistent that Germany has been moving in lockstep with the US on everything from the various stages of arms deliveries to Ukraine's pathway towards NATO membership. And yet, there clearly has been a degree of strategic tension beneath the surface, right from the weeks before the conflict, when Germany couldn't bring itself to believe that the US, these US intelligence warnings that a full-scale invasion was about to happen, through to the great tank dispute of early 2023, when, at least according to the German media reports, the US Defense Secretary really read the Riot Act, or the Levites, like I think you'd say in German, to Scholz's chief of staff over Berlin's refusal to give the Ukrainians Leopard 2 tanks. And in a way, this does remind me of the kind of Kissinger Brandt axis we were talking about a moment ago in the Ostpolitik years, when the Germans and Americans are acting along quite similar lines and share some interests, but they don't always share the same reasoning.
No, and I think that's partially because some of these events we just talked about are also underpinned not just by this kind of transatlantic spirit, but you have a counterpart to that, particularly on the German left. And I would say both that applies to both East and West Germany during the Cold War as well, where there's also quite a kind of continuous strand of anti-Americanism in Germany as well, particularly amongst kind of intellectuals, which, you know, hasn't gone away. So when you look at statistics, for example, you know, towards the war in Ukraine, you know, there are many people, particularly in what was East Germany, who believe that it's American aggression that's caused it in the first place, and kind of German lackeys pulling along with that. And I think that's, you know, that's got historical reasons. When you kind of grow up in an area where you've been told NATO is the enemy, NATO is not a defensive kind of agreement, but actually an imperialist undertaking, then, you know, that's hard to get back out after kind of decades worth of that being the, you know, the sort of pattern that you followed. Olaf Scholz famously in his younger years, when he was deputy leader of the young socialists, of the youth wing of the Social Democratic Party, also called NATO an imperialist venture. You know, this is kind of quite deeply ingrained as well, this anti-Americanism, particularly on the left. And I think that has always been a kind of antipode, if you will, to the love for America that many Germans feel as well. And they've been an intention, I think, throughout this entire time period.
So I think there's a very telling statistic that actually our generous benefactors at the Körperstiftung identified in their annual Berlin Pulse report in 2019, in the kind of absolute doldrums of German-American relations under the Trump era. And they ask every year a bunch of German respondents whether it's more important for Germany to have close relations with the US or with Russia, or to be equidistant. And this particular year, 39% said that they wanted to prioritize close relations with the US, 25% said they wanted to prioritize Russia, and 30% said they wanted equidistant. So you, at this point, 3 years before the second Russian invasion of Ukraine, 5 years after the first Russian invasion of Ukraine, have 55% of the German public that thinks Berlin should be at the very least equidistant between Russia and Germany. With conflicts in so many different theatres worldwide today, Ukraine, the Middle East, China, possibly if it decides to move against Taiwan, the German-American partnership seems as important as ever. We are delighted to have a guest with us today who could scarcely be better placed to shed some light on where the transatlantic partnership is now and how it might change in the future.
And that guest is none other than Lieutenant General Ben Hodges. Now retired, he's the former commanding general of US Army Europe, a position he held from 2014 to 2017. He currently serves as NATO Senior Mentor for Logistics and consults for several companies on Europe, NATO and the European Union. He is also the author of the book Future War and the Defence of Europe. He was most recently Senior Advisor to Human Rights First, a human rights organisation based in the US. Prior to that, he held the Pershing Chair in Strategic Studies at the Centre for European Policy Analysis. Native of Quincy, Florida, General Hodges graduated from the United States Military Academy in May 1980 and was commissioned as infantry officer in the US Army. General Hodges has also served in a variety of joint and army staff positions. From 2012 to 2014, he served as commander, NATO Allied Land Command in Izmir, Turkey. His last military assignment was as commanding general, United States Army Europe in Wiesbaden, Germany, from 2014 to 2017. He retired from the US Army in January 2018 and lives today with his wife in Frankfurt, Germany. Wow, that's an impressive CV, General Hodges. We're so pleased to have you here on The New Germany.
Well, thank you guys. And you just reminded me how old I am.
As we just laid out there, you have lived and served all over the world, South Korea, Iraq, Afghanistan, and yet it's Europe that continues to draw you back. Having served as commanding general US Army Europe, you've also retired here. So how does life in Frankfurt compare to Florida?
Well, of course, I love being here in Europe. I like the European lifestyle. And Frankfurt is an ideal location for me for the different types of things I do as a NATO senior mentor, as well as a consultant, and to work on my priorities of U.S.-Europe, U.S.-NATO, U.S.-Germany. Frankfurt is the great transportation hub, of course. And the fact that my wife is German and comes from originally from Heidelberg is also a powerful draw.
And with all those links between Europe and the US, you appear to be an unapologetic Atlanticist in an age where there seem to be few of those left. Why is the German-American relationship so important to you?
Well, look, America's prosperity and security depends on European prosperity and security. And all of our economic benefits that come from working closely with the European Union and with European countries are based on Europe being stable and secure. Otherwise, Europe will not be prosperous. So there's a sort of a, you could say, almost selfish economic interest in maintaining close relationship between North America and Europe. But also, the United States does not have the capability or the capacity to do everything it needs to do by itself. And all of our best and most reliable allies come from Europe, as well as Canada, Australia, and Japan. So I think the importance of maintaining those relationships and working with our European allies and partners is in the best interest of the United States.
And I mean, despite the centrality that this relationship clearly has for you personally, but also for the US, you said in a different podcast that quote, Germany is our most important ally, not our favorite ally. So is Germany more difficult to handle than America's other allies? And has it recognized the responsibilities that come with being such a chief partner for the United States and Europe?
Well, of course, the reason I say that, and I mean it, is because of the long-standing relationship between the United States and Germany that goes back to the middle of the 19th century and the large ethnic German population that makes up a significant portion of America. I mean, this relationship was interrupted, obviously, by two world wars, but the relationship predates that by many, many decades. And more Americans actually claim German ethnicity than any other ethnicity. So there's a long-standing relationship. And then, of course, in the almost 80 years now since the end of the Second World War, we're coming up on the 75th anniversary of the founding of NATO in 1949. You've had more than 15 million Americans have lived and served in uniform in Germany. That's more, not just Elvis Presley, but more than 15 million Americans have served in Germany since the end of the war as part of the alliance. And so the access that Germany gives us with our air base at Ramstein, the hospital at Landstuhl, the magnificent training areas at Grafenwehr and Hohenfels, the headquarters we have in Stuttgart, as well as Wiesbaden, troops, our industrial logistics hub in the Kaiserslautern area. This is important for America's strategic interests. We're not there to guard Germans. In fact, we have German security guards the American bases, but Germany allows us strategic platforms for protecting our strategic interests, not just in Europe, but also in Africa and the Middle East. So this is very important for us, as are our other European allies, but Germany is central to all of this. Now, when I say that Germany is not always our favorite ally, that means, of course, there are frustrations that go back over many different U.S. administrations, many different German governments, where we've had huge policy disagreements. I can remember being a lieutenant in the early 80s when there were enormous protests against the deployment of Pershing 2, for example. Or I would see Amis Raus spray painting on buildings, or, you know, RAF for the Rota Arma Faction spray painted. But I always knew that that was just part of living in a very vibrant democratic society in West Germany, and that most Germans, even if they groused a bit at, you know, U.S. troops living and training in Germany, rumbling through villages on reforger exercises, the vast majority of Germans respected and appreciated that America was there to help provide security in Europe. You can be sure every one of our allies has complained about the U.S., that we are not everybody's favorite ally, although I think most people would consider us their indispensable ally.
And you mentioned the huge German-American community earlier, and we talked about that a little bit in the first part of this podcast. Do they still have significant political influence in Washington today?
It's hard to tell. I think probably as a result of the First and Second World War, most German-Americans did not advertise their ethnicity. the way that the Irish and the Italians and the Spanish Mexicans do in the U.S., they tended to be more integrated or assimilated. And so you don't get the sense in a meaningful political way of a ethnic German American sort of constituency that you do with other ethnic groups. However, I would say that the traditional political beliefs and work ethic of Germans who came to the United States starting back in the 19th century is still very evident in states like Ohio, Michigan, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, in the America's heartland. And then it kind of works its way down through Kansas and even into Texas. There's a very strong ethnic German flavor there. And these are important states in American politics, what we often call swing states, that, you know, just a few thousand votes one way or the other can make a difference. And so when you have somebody like Senator Vance, J.D. Vance in the state of Ohio, that is a very vocal opponent of more aid to Ukraine and frequently uses Kremlin talking points, I hope that the Ohio voters who come from, whose parents and grandparents came from Germany, as well as Eastern Europe, will hold him accountable for failing to connect the dots on how Ukraine defeating Russia is important for American security.
I'd like to tease out some of the frustrations that you mentioned in today's setting. When you talk to people at the top of the German government about Germany's geopolitical orientation, they go to great pains to stress that they've been moving in lockstep with the US on Ukraine. One can, you know, certainly have a discussion about whether that has in fact always been the case. But what is certainly true is that Germany and the US have not always seen and acted eye to eye on China. So is there a risk here that Berlin sometimes takes a kind of pick and mix approach to Atlanticism?
Well, I suppose that could be true. Each nation, including my own, is going to work to achieve or protect its strategic interests. And Germany is a nation whose economy is based on export. And you know, all of us would like to have access to the Chinese market. And that's still very possible. But it's going to take the United States and Germany, UK, and other major industrial powers holding China accountable for living up to international agreement, to operating within the transparency requirements and financial requirements of international law. If Germany turns a blind eye to that, then China will exploit that, just as if the United States does not hold expectations that China complies with international law. China constantly disrupts or challenges freedom of navigation in international water. You know, that's a problem for Germany, whose economy depends on cars being able to be shipped across the Pacific. And if China does not respect international waters and freedom of navigation and sovereignty, that's a problem for Germany. And so Germany has the economic leverage and the political clout, and also, I would say, the moral authority after more than 75 years to challenge China. And so it is possible that we can work with China. We don't have to decouple, but we have to be smart and have our eyes wide open. Now, when it comes to Ukraine, I think most Germans may not even realize that Germany is the number two provider of overall aid to Ukraine, not just because there's over a million Ukrainians that live, refugees that are living in Germany, but in terms of military equipment, ammunition, financial aid, economic aid to Ukraine, Germany is number two behind the U.S. The combined efforts of European countries has surpassed that of the United States in terms of overall support to Ukraine. I think that's in large part due to German leadership. It does seem that the German government and the U.S. government appear to be working very closely together and are generally in agreement on certain things. Unfortunately, that also means that they are in agreement in a reluctance to use the phrase, "We want Ukraine to win," and therefore they are reluctant to provide Ukraine with enough of the capabilities needed for Ukraine to actually defeat Russian forces. The U.S. has been reluctant to provide the ATACMS, particularly the 300-kilometer range ATACMS that would make the Crimean Peninsula untenable for Russian forces. Germany has likewise refused to provide Taurus, which is an excellent cruise missile with a range of almost 500 kilometers, that it has, of which it has hundreds, and which would be very significant in helping Ukraine. So this is a place where, unfortunately, Germany and the U.S. do seem to be in lockstep, but in a negative way. Now, I have asked and tried to understand, what is the reason if Germany is clearly recognizes the threat that Russia presents? And Chancellor Scholz even referenced that the other day. And I think it's because the German government is very concerned about a possible return of Donald Trump as our president, and that Trump might pull the U.S. out of NATO, or at least not be as committed to European defense as every other American president always has been. And so I think the Bundeskanzler is concerned that if he provided Taurus to Ukraine, that somehow Germans could get drawn into this conflict with Russia without the benefit of a U.S. nuclear protection. The U.K. and France have nuclear weapons. Germany doesn't. And I think that affects how the Bundeskanzler thinks about this.
3 days into the second Russian invasion of Ukraine, Olaf Scholz gave his famous Zeitenwende speech in the Bundestag, where his two central commitments were the 100 billion rearmament fund for the Bundeswehr and a pledge to hit NATO's 2% target. It looks at the time we're having this conversation as though Germany is more or less on track to fulfill both of those promises, although it may take quite a generous definition of military spending to hit the NATO threshold. But from your perspective and from an American perspective, do you think that the Zeitenwende in its broader sense is going far enough towards meeting Germany's special responsibilities, both as a framework nation for the defense of NATO's eastern flank and as the U.S.'s most significant partner in Europe?
I actually am an optimist about what Germany is doing. I know this has been emotionally and psychologically very difficult for the Bundeskanzler to do this. I'm sure he never in his wildest imagination thought that he would one day be talking about 100 billion euro to rebuild German defense capabilities. That would be part of his responsibility as the Bundeskanzler. So, you know, he has to build up and maintain support across this coalition government and across Germany. What I have seen, though, over the past several years is that most Germans, when their leadership explains to them why they're doing what they're doing, most people agree. I mean, there were not huge protests in the streets after the Zeitenwende speech. There weren't big protests after Germany deployed the first enhanced forward presence battle group to Lithuania back in 2016. I think the German people, most of them at the end of the day, are practical and understand that they have responsibilities and that they can afford to do more. And there's also a moral responsibility. I've always been impressed that no German soldier, no member of the Bundeswehr can be deployed anywhere without a mandate from the Bundestag. I mean, that's impressive. But that also means then that if the Bundestag agrees that one man or one woman of the German Bundeswehr deploys somewhere, it is the moral responsibility of the Bundestag to ensure that they have everything they can possibly need in terms of training, readiness, best possible equipment to have a chance to survive, as well as to accomplish the mission. That's a moral responsibility of the Bundestag. And so it does feel like gradually more and more Germans are coming to accept that, you know, this is, we're not sliding down the slope towards a return to 1930s Germany, but instead this is the Germany that is accepting responsibility for protecting the liberal democratic institutions from which Germany has prospered more than anybody else in Europe.
This is a question that may well come into sharper focus if Donald Trump wins the presidential election in November. But does the special relationship between Germany and the U.S. sometimes entail a responsibility for Berlin to talk back at the U.S. and push it where it doesn't seem to be going far enough from NATO or Europe's perspective on things like aid to Ukraine or its maintenance of the credible Article 5 deterrent?
Well, I think as former Bundespräsident Gauck said just a few years ago, is that friends have higher expectations of friends. And so on a relationship that is Augenhöhe, that, you know, we are allies and partners in leadership, like President George H.W. Bush said, I would expect that Germany would be critical of U.S. policy, critical of decisions or stances taken by an American administration that does not conform to expectations and agreements and shared values. This is normal statecraft. And I also, of course, very concerned about what a return of Trump to the presidency would mean. He is a real threat to democracy. He clearly, absolutely, clearly sees himself as a dictator, although he makes jokes about it in public and his supporters are saying, oh, he's just joking. But you can be sure that given every opportunity, he's already made it clear that he will use his position for retribution against those who challenged him. And whether it's in the legal system or in other aspects of American society, what concerns me more than Trump is that there are millions of Americans that would support him and vote for him and cheer and laugh at his preposterous statements. So we've got a challenge inside the United States now. And our German friends and allies, understandably, are very concerned about what they see and what they hear. I still believe 60-65% of Americans are not crazy, that we will eventually get this sorted out, but it's going to be painful getting to that point. And so Germany and other countries that depend on the United States should hold us accountable.
So with these challenges in mind, in an ideal world, what would you want Berlin and Washington to do over the next 10 years to strengthen the German-American relationship?
Well, I would say that Germany and other European countries could take away some of the Trump talking points, and not only Trump, but I mean, as you probably know, and your listeners know, there is a streak of isolationism in America. It's been there from our beginning. So take away the talking point that, you know, hey, Europeans are free riders. That's a derogatory phrase that President Obama used, that, you know, city slang, a free rider is somebody that hops on and off a streetcar, you know, without paying for it. Take away that by demonstrating that Germany and other European countries accept responsibility for security and stability, that you're not able to enjoy, you're able to enjoy this very good education and healthcare system and pretty generous pension because you know that the U.S. is providing security. That's what aggravates Americans, and every American president since Truman has complained about this. So that would, I think, undermine some of the complaints by people like Trump and his supporters, as if Europe was seen as doing everything necessary to make itself to contribute to the overall defense of Europe, both within NATO, but in Europe more broadly. I think that's an expectation that that certainly I have and most Americans would have of our German allies. I think that the economic power, the reason I've always thought of Germany as our most important ally was not only because of the historical ties and the geographic location, but also the moral authority that Germany has earned since the end of the war. I mean, no country has done more to try and atone for its historical past than has Germany, maybe even to excess. But that's given you a chance and accumulated moral authority that should be used. Tired of hearing Germans say never again if they don't actually use that moral authority to ensure never again.
Well, those are some really useful hints. I hope your word will reach ears in Berlin. Sadly, we don't have any more time to set the German-American relationship up for the future. But thank you so much for your immense expertise and for being with us and our listeners today.
Well, thanks to both of you for the opportunity you've given me to come onto your podcast. So I really do appreciate it.
And we usually ask our guests for any reading recommendations, including shameless plugs of their own material. So aside from your book, Future War and the Defense of Europe, what else would you suggest reading on these topics we've been talking about?
Well, you know, of course, there are so many people out there writing today, but I really like reading. There's a woman, Dr. Heather Cox Richardson, that puts out every day something called Letters from an American. She's an historian, and she uses history to highlight current or contemporary political issues. And I look forward every day to her newsletter as it comes out, because she provides the historical foundation in the context, whether it's an amendment about voting rights or economic efforts to raise the lower and middle class, how our taxes situation came to be where it is today, I would encourage people to look for Letters from an American, Dr. Heather Cox Richardson.
Well, so that does sound fascinating as somebody who loves doing the same thing on Germany. That sounds absolutely amazing. Well, there's not much left for me to say other than that's a wrap.
Do you know that the phrase goes all the way back to the 1920s when filmmakers started saying it to show that the shooting was finished and the film was ready to go into post-production?
You know, your mind's become very literal from all that Germanic living you do in Berlin. I was subtly trying to end this episode where we started on the importance of movies in the German-American relationship.
Right. Well, am I still invited to the wrap party?
If you bring Coca-Cola and gute Laune.
You're on. Auf Wiederhören from Berlin und bis zum nächsten Mal in diesem Theater.
Genau. Bye-bye from Norfolk.